This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. January 6th, the day when mobs descended on the Capitol building in Washington, will live very long in the memories of millions of Americans. For Jamie Raskin, that is especially the case. Raskin is a Democrat representing Maryland's 8th Congressional District. Just a week earlier, he had tragically lost his son, Tommy, a law student who suffered from depression and took his life on New Year's Eve. The Raskin family laid Tommy to rest on the 5th. And on the 6th, Jamie Raskin went to the Capitol. One of his daughters and a son-in-law went with him for moral support because Raskin had a crucial job to do. He was defending the certification of the Electoral College and the election of Joe Biden. That's the process that Donald Trump and his supporters just could not abide, and they wanted to stop it by any means necessary. When the mob breached the building, threatening violence on lawmakers, Raskin and his family were all in danger, along with so many others. When the House impeached Donald Trump for his role in inciting that insurrection, Jamie Raskin was the lead manager prosecuting the case.
This trial is personal indeed for every senator, for every member of the House, every manager, all of our staff, the Capitol Police, the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police, the National Guard, maintenance and custodial crews, the print journalists and TV people who were here, and all of our families and friends. And I hope this trial reminds America how personal democracy is, and how personal is the loss of democracy, too.
I reached Jamie Raskin last week as he was traveling with his family. Now, Congressman, this moment is, I have to think, the first moment you've had to breathe since so much. And I have to ask you, how do you begin to process all this?
Well, I'll probably spend the rest of my life trying to process the last couple of months because some, you know, very profound and terrible things have happened to our family. But we've also been the beneficiary of a lot of love and a lot of solidarity. And I got to participate in an extraordinary effort to defend American constitutional democracy against the tyranny of Donald Trump and the violent insurrection that he unleashed against us.
Do you feel that you succeeded?
Well, yeah, I do. We of course impeached him in the House of Representatives. So he is a now twice impeached president for his crimes against the union, his high crimes against the union. And we received 57 votes in the Senate in the most bipartisan presidential impeachment conviction vote in the history of the United States. That was 57 to 43. We won 7 Republicans over, as well as all of the Democrats. But the reason I consider it a success is because we irrefutably convicted the president in the court of public opinion. We irrefutably convicted him in the court of history. And he will increasingly become an absolute pariah. My mistake was to think that we were going to win this thing 100-0. I always thought it was more likely that we would win 100-0 than 67-33. When people said to me, you know, where are you going to get the 17 Republican votes? I said, I'm not going for 17 Republican votes. We're going for 100 votes. We want the evidence to be so overwhelming and unrefuted and irrefutable that everybody says there's nothing else that can be done. But we underestimated the moral and political cowardice of a lot of people in the Republican Party who are just accepting the autocratic bullying of Donald Trump. It's a pretty shocking thing.
Congressman, you and your family suffered a loss that's unspeakable, unimaginable, and everyone, all of my colleagues, and I'm sure all the listeners, send their deepest condolences. I don't know how you summoned the will to do what you did. How did you manage to not just get out of bed, but move forward and appear on the public stage and summon the intelligence and all that's necessary to perform as you did, if I can use that word, in the well of the Senate and make your case and organize the prosecution? How did you do it? How did you manage?
Well, you've got to read some of my son Tommy Raskin's writings and talk to some of the people who knew Tommy. He was just the most magnificent young man. He had a perfect heart and a perfect soul and an extraordinary mind. And he was profoundly committed to democracy and everything we might be able to create through democracy, a world that values each person and gives each person the opportunity to flourish and to excel and shine. So I had my son with me in my heart, in my chest the entire time. I felt him. And I, of course, was surrounded by this magnificent team of managers, all of whom I'm very close to.
But your son was speaking to you in some sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, I you know, not in any supernatural sense, but I felt very much his presence and his strength and his beliefs. You know, Tommy was someone who was 10,000 years ahead of his time in terms of his thinking. I mean, really, he had just exceptional visionary qualities that everybody recognized around him. But he felt every bit of pain and hardship and injustice in the world. It was with him. And so Donald Trump, to me, represents everything antithetical to strong democracy and human rights and the civilizing movements of our time. And I hope that the trial will be remembered as a time when we told the truth about what Donald Trump did to America.
How close were we to losing American democracy?
Very close. Very close. You know, Mike Pence really was a critical actor that night. You know, I was working with a team of people, including Joe Neguse, getting ready for Wednesday, January 6th, because we had anticipated all of the extreme parliamentary tactics that were being used to try to thwart the counting of the Electoral College votes, try to nullify the electors from swing states that went for Biden, including Pennsylvania and Georgia and Arizona. We saw all that stuff coming. We knew that was going to happen. And it really did come down to, in the morning, Trump told Pence, you're going to go down in history as a patriot or a pussy. But if Pence had given in, just like if Raffensperger had given in Georgia or these other Republican legislative leaders had given in different states, we could be in a very different situation. If Pence had said,
we'll send three or four states back. There's just too much confusion because of what Trump has done, and it's foggy. And now there's no majority in the Electoral College. We kick it over to a contingent election in the House. At that point, the Republicans would have won because it's their vote, one vote, one state, rather than one vote, one member. And they had a majority in the state delegations. And so Trump was saying it's not going to take much for Pence to give us the election. Then Trump could have come in and say, we've won. I'm going to impose martial law because of all this chaos that he had unleashed on us. I think we were very close to having a coup, or what the political scientists call a self-coup, in the country.
Congressman, has President Biden reached out to you?
President Biden very kindly called Sarah and me and our daughters after we lost Tommy. So we spoke to him then.
What was that conversation like?
Well, it was very powerful. He obviously has experienced a lot of loss of intimate family. I mean, his son Beau, and he's lost. I mean, you know, it's been a nightmare for him. And so he connects very strongly with people who are going through that kind of grief and that kind of agony. And we found it enormously soothing and reassuring to hear from him. And I could not be happier that he is the president that we have at a time of such grief and devastation in the country because of COVID-19 and all of the other plagues that have been unleashed upon us during the course of the Trump presidency. Joe Biden really leads from the heart. And we heard from also Vice President Kamala Harris, who was equally beautiful and tender in her comments to us. So it meant a lot to our daughters, and it meant a lot to Sarah and me to hear from the president in that way. And he called me after the first day of the trial, and he said, you're a great lawyer, but you're an even better father. And I'll never forget that.
Extraordinary. Congressman, the other day, President Biden said he was tired of talking about Trump. In fact, he tried to avoid using his name.
I know how he feels. I agree completely. People who live in authoritarian societies just say that's what it's like to have a fascist, authoritarian, demagogue kind of leader. You know, it violates every boundary that you have between what's public and what's private. It inhabits every nook and cranny of your existence. And Donald Trump, you know, demands that kind of totalitarian attention. And it's been exhausting for the country for 4 years. And it would be great if we could forget about him. Unfortunately, we can't because of, 10 missing votes in the Senate. We can't forget about him. It's not over. This former president, this disgraced, twice impeached president, is going to be the subject of criminal prosecutions for the rest of his natural days, civil litigation, class action suits, KKK Act civil prosecutions.
You sound pretty confident that he'll be, in a sense, litigated into oblivion.
I think that his victims are not going to let it rest.
Congressman, what rest, ease do you and your family anticipate in the weeks to come, or is the work just too relentless? What do you afford yourself?
I've been quite exhausted by the last several weeks, and so we're getting some rest, and we're staying together, and we're with other family, and we're with other friends, and we're trying to read through the thousands of letters we've gotten at different points in this sequence of events. But I'm not going anywhere. This is all of our historical assignment to defend American democracy, and it's a beautiful struggle, and it's an urgent struggle. It's an imperative. So I plan to be right there with my colleagues and right there with the great movements of our time, defending in American democracy that really will be a model to the world of how you create a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural constitutional democracy that works. And that's threatening to a lot of people.
I heard that one of your colleagues in the House said to you something that just astonished me. She said, you have to respect Tommy's decision. What did she mean by that?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I don't know. Obviously, we have to accept his decision. He wrote us a note on that day which said, please forgive me. My illness won today. Look after each other, the animals, and the global poor for me. All my love, Tommy. And I mean, we miss him every second, you know. You know, his illness was very painful, extraordinarily painful. I mean, you know, we've asked doctors what it's like, and you know, they say for people in it, it's just you see no way out. It's just blindingly painful. And our daughter Tabitha said something that was pretty profound, because she said Tommy was above all a utilitarian. He wanted to maximize the happiness and the well-being and the good for the most number of people and animals and reduce the pain and suffering. And she said, so either he looked at it and he said that our pain and suffering in response to his leaving us was less than his pain and suffering going through this, because he knew for us it would be spread out among many, many people in our family and friends and even in the rest of the world now. She said, so either he made that basic utilitarian judgment, or she said he committed the first selfish act of his life.
Congressman Raskin, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Jamie Raskin of Maryland. I spoke with him last week. You can find the Tommy Raskin Memorial Fund online. And if you're having thoughts of suicide yourself or one of your loved ones is, please ask for help. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is at 800-273-TALK. 800-273-TALK. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. We'll be back in a moment.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Biden administration has spent much of its first month in office focusing on how to tame the pandemic. But much of the news is still pretty grim. The vaccine rollout continues to be chaotic, and it's plagued by inequities of all kinds. And no less important, new variants, mutations of the virus, are circulating in the world, and we have yet to get a handle on how to deal with them. Atul Gawande is a surgeon and a public health expert, and recently, he served on the COVID task force of the Biden transition team, which was disbanded just after the president was sworn in. He's been a staff writer for The New Yorker for many years. Atul, we had the first doses in the United States administered just over a couple of months ago. How is that rollout going?
The vaccine rollout, so, you know, at the very beginning, it seemed like we were all breakthrough and no follow-through. We hit 1.7 million vaccines a day. Basically, the capacity to deliver vaccination has been rising steadily. And around the 26th, we'll have the presentation of the Johnson & Johnson data on their vaccine to the FDA, which could mean, I think it's likely we'll see an approval within a week after that and a whole new supply chain coming. So those, you know, where we are on vaccine delivery is in the top five in the world. So I consider us to be starting to turn the corner here.
I guess what's so disturbing to me and unnerving is the amount of resistance that we see to vaccines. We have some populations who are very suspicious of government, and for good reason historically. We have the anti-vaxxer movement, which has its doubts, whether either through conspiracy theory or doubts about the science. We have all kinds of populations and millions of people, if you add it up, who are resistant. Why isn't the government, Oprah Winfrey, whatever would be effective on television and radio and on the internet 24 hours a day, helping make this effort easier?
The vaccine definitely has had a level of anxiety, but the actual anti-vaccine attack has been relatively muted. As more vaccine rolls out, and we're past 40 million people vaccinated now, you are talking about, you know, a case where people all know somebody who's been vaccinated. They're seeing what the effects are. They've seen that we haven't seen suddenly, you know, unusual deaths or anything like that occurring. And so the vaccine confidence has risen enormously. We now have more than 70% of Americans reporting that if they had the chance to get the vaccine today, they would take it. That is higher than we've seen, and I think that will continue to rise. There are still a bunch of people who are fence-sitters. Those are smaller in number, but that doesn't alarm me. I totally understand the impulse to say, I want to wait. I do think we have clear evidence that getting the vaccine is far better than getting the coronavirus.
That is for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Atul, you just published a piece about Minot, North Dakota, and the drama there and the politics of the public health measures, not just the vaccination itself. Why did you choose to concentrate on that town, and what did you find?
I got interested in Minot because North Dakota in the fall was the state with the worst outbreak, and Minot was in the county that was the worst hit in North Dakota. And I want to understand what is making it so difficult for us to come together and address the crisis. Because in North Dakota, they had not embraced having a statewide mask requirement. And in Minot, the city council took up the question, are we going to be willing to do something as their hospital was pleading for help from being overrun? And, you know, it was raising this question, our democracy has frayed, and has it frayed so badly that it can't manage the crisis?
there was also a lack of ability to persuade, a lack of connection and integrity somehow between city council members, particularly city council members who wanted a mask law, and ordinary citizens who were in deep danger and seeing people all around them getting sick.
Well, I actually, so, you know, the interesting thing to me is I came away feeling like this was a success story. It wasn't pretty. There was deep divide. I showcased Kerry Evans, who introduced the proposal for the city to adopt a mask mandate, and Tom Ross on the other side, who was absolutely against adopting masks. And they were coming from two different worlds. But, you know, as I talked to Tom Ross and other opponents of the masks there, it wasn't that they were blind to how sick people were. They, you know, Tom Ross knew the first person who died in Minot. He became sick with the coronavirus himself. He was worried he would die. But they felt like the debate was all about deaths, deaths, deaths. What about all the damage of the response to the virus was their concern, whether it was kids who hadn't been in school for a year, the mental health damage, the rise in alcohol, domestic abuse, and what they felt like they saw as a destruction in their entire lives, making the connection that what we do now for the virus will help solve all of those problems. Tom Ross wasn't persuaded, and many of the opponents weren't persuaded, but the community was. And they not only passed the mask mandate, but by the end, 90% of people in North Dakota ended up adopting face masks. They restricted their movements. There was strong opposition. You won't get to consensus, but they were able to move forward and actually get the hospitalizations and the deaths down. They got it down, you know, 80%.
You recently wrote an op-ed that emphasized, whether it's Pfizer or AstraZeneca, that all vaccines prevent hospitalization and death due to COVID-19. But we're also being told at the same time, Atul, even once you've been vaccinated, you should still practice social distancing. So do you think public health officials have been making a mistake by downplaying the efficacy of the vaccine somehow?
Well, so it's worth pulling these two things apart. And it is hard to grasp that on the one hand, these vaccines appear to be, evidence so far, you know, almost 100% protective against the worst outcomes of the of these infections, hospitalization and death. On the other hand, it is not at all clear that they stop you from being infected. And, you know, we don't know if it stops you from transmitting. We are seeing from some of the results in the UK signs that, you know, there is some transmission that likely does go on from people who get infected. And because of the development of mutations, that is a concern, that if we continue spreading such high levels, I mean, we have hundreds of thousands of people who are actively infected with the virus right now, we will need to get to the point where we've shut down that transmission as well.
A simple question. If you're fortunate enough to get vaccinated and soon, how does that do against the what we're hearing about new strains and mutations of the virus?
Well, so there's two different stories here, which only makes this story more complicated, right? So half of my answer to you about like why are public health people making this so complicated is that the damn science keeps being complicated. So the UK variant, the B117 variant, its doubling time is only 10 days. It's past 5% of all of the infections in Florida. And it is a variant that is 30 to 50% more contagious, which means 30 to 50% more hospitalizations, deaths just from that. Plus, it is more lethal. It is more likely to put you in the hospital. And that one is the one that alarms me a great deal. We have a very effective vaccines. Our vaccines work against this variant. Israel is predominantly infected by this variant, and they've had a 94% reduction in infections among people who got the vaccine. So what I think is the single most important thing is getting as many people over 65 or with two comorbidities vaccinated within the next 12 weeks. The second part is the South African variant and the Brazil variant are further mutations that add on to what UK mutation. And those show some signs of potentially evading the vaccine. Now, we have it popping up in small numbers in the United States. We don't know if it will spread as quickly as the UK variant will, but those are clearly going to need vaccine boosters, perhaps in the fall, perhaps in a year from now.
Now, guidelines are all over the place in the United States. You live in the Boston area, and in Massachusetts, they just announced a new, and I thought pretty surprising, vaccine guideline that anyone accompanying an adult over the age of 75 gets a vaccine too. Why'd they do that?
Well, so one of the interesting things that happened, and it's happening in many states, which is they opened up to everybody over 75, and a lot of 75-year-olds came in, but not everybody. For example, in Massachusetts, 200,000 of the 430,000 people over the age of 75 came in and got vaccinated, but that meant the majority did not. And I thought it was incredibly creative that here in my state, they said, hey, bring in one of those folks who are missing and you'll get vaccinated as well. You know, it led to crazy headlines about people offering to pay the elderly $200 and I'll give you a ride to get your vaccine. People are that desperate to get vaccinated themselves. And a lot of anger, you know, I'm going to see a 25-year-old jump the line or people who are connected and well-off jumping the line. But in some ways, what I really appreciate is the idea that the people with the connections will be reaching out and getting the people who don't have that ability to navigate the system and get them in. I'm part of running a bunch of vaccine centers, and it's worked. We are seeing a lot of folks come in that otherwise wouldn't have been able to come in or weren't coming in.
What do we still need to improve on in this process if we're going to get to anything like universal or at least near universal vaccination?
I think the areas of next opportunity are ones that continue to reduce the barriers. You know, one thing I've advocated for example, is we have a crazy billing system in the United States. It's $17 that Medicare will pay for a single vaccine. Setting up the billing systems has slowed down the vaccine operations. Sending out the bills, you know, can cost $5 to send a bill for a $17 vaccine. We're going to need to give this to every American. We should get money from the insurers. I would advocate saying, look, your insurers should pay for every member, but send that money to the government and let's just get rid of the billing part of this. That would simplify the software. We're seeing people being asked to give their insurance card, of course. And then you tell them, well, it's not going to cost you anything, but I want your insurance card. You know how many people don't trust that? All of that can go away. There are many aspects of trying to make the system streamlined that are going well. There's still more that can be knocked out, and I hope they'll continue to get at them.
Now, the last time we spoke, it was December, and you told me that you think we might return to normal sometime this summer. And given the new information about variants and vaccination and everything we've been talking about, where does your answer stand now?
So it has gotten more complicated. I didn't imagine we would have strains that would potentially evade the vaccines. And we also have the complexity that the trials for kids are not complete. The studies in kids age 12 and older are going to come out in late summer. And the trials in kids age 6 and up are only starting now. So that means a big part of the population will still potentially be affected by COVID. So, you know, where will we be? My suspicion is we're going to be in a world by end of summer where we don't have hospitalizations and don't have deaths in the kinds, anything like the numbers we've had. We will have it down below flu level numbers. Once we're below flu level numbers, the country is going to want to throw the mask away.
And that's a mistake.
Well, I think it's going to be a real debate, because if our goal was get to zero, then we weren't going to, you know, that would be the moment when we say everybody get free. But when the goal is now that knowing we're not going to get to zero, it's that we need to be able to get back to our lives. And we're going to have a real debate, even among public health people, about where to draw that line. But I think by the fall, we're going to be, and summer, we're going to be in the thick of a debate about, well, if it's below where flu was, can we tolerate that? I compare it to when we decided we're going to move the speed limit back up from 55 miles an hour to 65 miles an hour, knowing that was going to be thousands of deaths a year, and it continues to be debated. But, you know, we decided this was where we drew the line, and it was a political decision as much as a public health one.
When you say it's going to take a while, at what point can I go to the movies, to Yankee Stadium, to take an airplane flight, not with a mask and not be thinking about this all the time?
So this is what makes it hard. I think the most likely thing is this gets beaten down to become an endemic chronic flu-like illness that circulates, that we will have developed some antiviral treatments as well. I think we will also have discovered that wearing the mask stops the flu, which it did this last year, and any remaining COVID in circulation. And we're going to have some changes in norms where there are people who decide, you know what, it's perfectly fine to wear the mask when I travel and I'm in places because I don't want to get a cold. I don't want to get COVID. So, you know, we will be in a new place, I think, by the fall. It'll feel much more like normal. And we may well be, you know, commonly wearing masks.
Atul Gawande is a staff writer and a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He'll join me again soon as we follow the course of the recovery from the COVID pandemic. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Fred Hampton, a leader in the Black Panther Party, was shot in his bed by Chicago police in a pre-dawn raid. He was just 21 years old. The raid was facilitated by an informant, a teenager by the name of William O'Neill. The half-century quest for justice by activists, lawyers, and Hampton's family has revealed the enormous extent of the FBI's role in what happened, all the way up to J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover had issued a directive that he wanted to prevent the rise of some kind of messiah. That was his word, a messiah, who would unify the Black community. In the new film, Judas and the Black Messiah, Hampton is played by Daniel Kaluuya, an actor you undoubtedly know from Black Panther or Get Out. The film follows Hampton in the last year of his life as he works to found the Rainbow Coalition, a movement that would bring together Blacks, rural and working class whites, and Latinos.
Hello.
Okay. Daniel, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am very well. Thanks for doing this. I'm Kai.
Kaluuya spoke with Kai Wright of WNYC's program, The United States of Anxiety.
When did you realize you wanted to be a storyteller and an actor?
My teachers used to tell my mom like he should get into acting. And I realized back in the day, like my mom actually told another mom. She said like yeah, she got me into that to get me off the streets, essentially. It was, you know, you could get sucked into a couple energies, you know. So on the Fridays and the Saturdays and the Sundays, I was just doing something, you know. And because it was improvisation, you know, it was really scary at the beginning as a 13-year-old doing it. And then I found that you could have a career of it. There was people in my class that were on TV. Not in my class. There was people in the more advanced classes that were on TV, and I'd see them, and I was, wow, like, you're on TV. Is it possible? I think improv is, what I say is improv is a creative art and acting is an interpretive art. So there's something about improv is like inherently satisfying, essentially. So you're just creating something out of nothing. And when it hits, you know? And I would just really challenge myself and always would do something different every week. I didn't really look at a script for the first 3 years of me doing acting. So when people gave me words, I was like, what, are you going to tell me what to say? It's amazing.
And did you ever return to writing, writing plays and whatnot?
I got back into the writing when I was 16, writing plays. But I never used to write them down. I used to tell people, yo, do this, do that. From there, I was formulating ideas in that way. I realized that this was my thing. And then Skins happened and then we was rolling.
Right. Skins ran for some years on British TV, but it was at least a decade before you had a lead in a big Hollywood film, which was Jordan Peele's Get Out. And I don't know if you understand just how much that shook so many of us here in the U.S., how much your performance grabbed people like me. How'd you come to that role?
It's funny because it's I was in a really, when it started, I was in a bad spot in my life. I've got a lot of rejection of the color of my skin. You know what I'm saying? I would get roles and then execs would come in and say, no black leads. So I was in a weird position where I felt like I'd done the time. I realized it wasn't meritocracy, you know what I'm saying, this industry. It wasn't I was pissed that it wasn't a meritocracy. It was I was annoyed that I believed in it. You know what I'm saying? I was like, man, I believed them. They told me something and I believed them. And so I didn't act for a year and a half and I just dipped out. And I was just like, yo, let me take time. Let me just figure out who I am. Why am I doing this? Why do I act?
Well, I mean, certainly it was just the beginning of an eruption of essential performances from you. So, you play in Black Panther in 2018, and then later that year you're in Widows by Steve McQueen, and then you follow that up with a lead role in the film Queen and Slim.
That was really challenging because it was I felt like you don't really see characters like that in narratives because he's content. He doesn't want more than what he has. Do you know what I'm saying? He wants a lady to share that with, but that's it. And I realized that was a real challenge for me because possibly I wasn't content and I wanted more than what I have. But what's that communicating about me to me? It's going, oh, Dan, you don't like yourself or you don't feel you're enough. You feel me? Slim thinks he's enough. His life is enough. I think that's a beautiful thing to say. And you don't really see black people go, yeah, I'm good.
Well, that feels like a great transition to talking about Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton in Judas and the Black Messiah. I wonder, before you read the script, what did you know about the Black Panther Party? What did you bring into this in terms of that history?
I knew I wasn't taught a lot at school about it. Very minimal. It was a passing comment. Then, I kind of just was taking stuff in naturally, just dealing with the frustrations of being a young black man in a white country, and actually caring deeply about self-empowerment. And I would just be gravitating towards the Black Panther Party's ideologies and philosophies and concepts. And
if back then, before you made the film, before you started studying, if somebody had asked you, to describe the Black Panther Party, how would you have described it?
People who were uncompromising about protecting themselves. Is how I would have described it before.
And did you know about the history of the FBI's role in trying to dismantle the Panthers? Were you familiar with that history as well?
I was aware of the Black Messiah mandate agenda. I was aware of that. And I don't know when that came to me, but I remember going, what the? They did what? They tried to do what? I remember that going, whoa, this is...
What about Fred Hampton himself? I mean, I have to say, I imagine any time an actor steps forward to play a notable person like this, it's got to be complicated, right? Because we're all watching and we already have all these ideas about this person. And in this case, somebody like Fred Hampton, I mean, he really means something quite deep and emotional to many of us. To me, he's literally a martyr in the struggle for my own personal freedom. That's how I see him. So I just wonder how you mentally, how you physically would prepare or did prepare for a role like that.
It's a lot, bro. It was a lot. I went Shaka King, the director, amazing director. I asked him about the Black Panther reading list. So in order to be a fully fledged Panther, you need to go on 6 weeks of political education. So I said, "What's the reading list?" So he sent me the reading list, and I just started reading. You know, I started reading the books, and I just saw it as like I needed to get into the. Before I started looking at Chairman Fred, I needed to get into the mindset and the idea what they were talking about. You know, and getting into it from a late 60s point of view as opposed to a 2018, 2019 point of view.
Because we've grown so accustomed to being poor, we think it's normal for our kids to go to school hungry. We think it's normal for us to go to the hospital with a runny nose and come home with a body bag. So our job as a Black Panther Party is to heighten the contradictions.
I pledge allegiance to my Black people.
You know, one of my favorite scenes in Judas and the Black Messiah, it might be when Deborah Johnson, who's Fred Hampton's partner, played by Dominique Fishback, she catches you listening to a speech, and I think it was Malcolm X, and you're kind of mimicking him like a kid lip-syncing to a pop song almost. And I got to say, I was really sort of taken back to my own teenage years there, listening to recordings of Louis Farrakhan and trying to sort of mimic his voice myself. And it struck me that you were performing a performer in some ways who did not consider himself a performer, right?
No, I didn't see it as a performance. I think if I saw it at a performance, then I'm engaged with ego, like Chairman Fred's ego. I think he's a student, you know, and like understanding that he really, really did listen to Malcolm X speeches and Martin Luther King speeches in order to build his skill set of public speaking. But it's that kind of like I don't feel like it would have served me to see him as a performer because it was very real to him. His want and desire for people to awaken for themselves manifested with those speeches and the way that he told those speeches.
I don't believe I'm gonna die, no Corey. No. I don't believe I'm gonna die slipping on no ice. No. I don't believe I'm gonna die because I got a bad heart. No. I believe I'm gonna die doing what I was born for. I believe I'm gonna die half the people. I'm gonna die for the people because I live for the people. I live for the people because I love the people.
I think it was so important to see him as a human being, you know. Someone calls him an icon and this and that, you know, and he is that. But he's an icon because he's a human being, and because he's a human being that loved deeply and he loved Black people deeply. That's why he's an icon. And to have access, it goes, yeah, he was 21.
21 years old. It's one of the things that just keeps sticking out to me. They were so young. They were babies doing these remarkable things. I want to ask you about a scene that doesn't include your character, but I think is really important. It's because it shows the differences between someone like Fred Hampton and Bill O'Neill, who was the FBI's informant, played by Lakeith Stanfield. The two men, of course, could not be further apart in terms of how they lived, how they viewed the world. And while watching the scene, I wondered how Hampton would have responded to the FBI agent, Roy Mitchell. He's played by Jesse Plemons. And here the agent explains the purpose of their work to the informant. So let's listen to that.
Don't let Hampton fool you. The Panthers and the Klan are one and the same. Their aim is to sow hatred and inspire terror. Plain and simple. Now, I'm all for civil rights, but you can't cheat your way to equality. And you certainly can't shoot your way to it.
That, for me, that line is there. It's like seeing the radicalness of their perspective on things. Do you know what I'm saying? And how they present it in such a rational way. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, the people who lynch Black people, the Ku Klux Klan, are the same as people who feed kids. This is what we are engaging with. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and I'm like, I'm saying that one line illuminated so much to me. And I'm like, oh, wow, I didn't see it like that. Like, because you don't hear that point of view. I don't know, but it's like, I think it's important for us to really dissect, like, this is how they see us. The antagonization rooted in white fear and white anxiety, them being named terrorists because they educated kids, because they loved themselves, because they was uncompromising with that.
That was experienced as terrorism by certainly the FBI.
Look at the film. Everyone's looking at O'Neill, but O'Neill was action activated by the FBI. Let's not sleep. Do you know what I'm saying? Let's not sleep. He was a kid put in a situation by men. And they said, you either go in prison or you're doing this.
But let me ask you this about O'Neill, because I've also heard Shaka King, the writer and director, say, you know, he wanted viewers to wrestle with where we each fit in the spectrum between these two people, Fred Hampton and Bill O'Neill, you know, this the communitarian versus the individualist, the socialist versus the capitalist, this brave Hampton versus a truly terrified Bill O'Neill. And I wonder then for yourself, as you were making this film, you know, if Shaka King wanted us to wrestle with that as individuals, did you have occasion to wrestle with that with yourself?
Removed from the film, I can really see O'Neill's position and see the dangers of apathy, you know, the dangers of indifference. You think you're preserving yourself, but you are destroying yourself. I can see that in that, yeah.
I have to ask you also before we go about your next project or an upcoming project, as I understand it, which at least on the surface sounds to me like quite a departure from all the work we've been talking about. Barney the Dinosaur? I understand you're going to produce a film about Barney. Why Barney?
Why not? The reason why I fell in love with film because I watch kids' films. You can really allow really credible messages to go through that because you go to the base and core of storytelling. And what really resonated with me is that Barney said, I love you, you love me, won't you say you love me too? And people hate him. But he never actually taught us, like, what happens if that person doesn't love you back.
Oh, wow.
I just found it really profound.
Is it going to be a feature film or a documentary? And when can we expect to have this?
It's a film and it's being built now. So, you know. You know, and that's all I'm saying, Kai. That's it. You've got a lot already. You've got a lot already, my guy.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Appreciate you, my bro. All right, take care, yeah? Thank you so much, guys.
I need everybody to repeat after me. I am a revolutionary. I am a revolutionary. I am a revolutionary.
The actor Daniel Kaluuya. He spoke to WNYC's Kai Wright, who's the host of The United States of Anxiety. Judas and the Black Messiah is in theaters now and streaming. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for us this week. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Lea, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.